From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, cinematographer Haskell Wexler. He won Oscars for his work on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory. This year, he won the American Society of Cinematographers Lifetime Achievement Award. Also today, actor Jeff Bridges. He's starring in the new film American Heart as an ex-con just out of jail who's reunited with the son he abandoned. And are books becoming obsolete? We hear from linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Russia's foreign minister has launched a peace effort for Bosnia as Bosnian Serbs appear set to defy the international community. In a two-day referendum, Bosnian Serbs rejected the Vance-Owen peace plan. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Belgrade.
Even before the last votes were cast, the Bosnian Serb leader, Dr. Radovan Karadzic, said the Vance-Owen peace plan was dead and he wanted a new one. The rejection of the peace plan has been a defiant one, perhaps too defiant. Today, Dr. Karadzic apologized for remarks by a military commander who threatened to bomb London and Washington if the West mounted military strikes. While the Bosnian Serbs were pronouncing the last rites on the Vance-Owen plan, the Russian foreign minister tried to revive it. Andrei Kozarov launched a peace initiative that takes him to Western capitals and the Balkans. The Russians have called for a UN Security Council meeting on Friday and want to press ahead in implementing the Vance-Owen plan. In Belgrade, this is Deborah Amos.
In Bosnia, fighting continues between Croatian and Muslim-led government forces in the southern part of the nation. Meanwhile, in eastern Bosnia, Serbian troops shattered a truce around a UN-declared safe area. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says now that Bosnian Serbs have turned down a UN-sponsored peace agreement. The U.S. will talk with Western allies about new ways to end the fighting in Bosnia. Christopher says there's a possibility that rejection of the peace plan could open up new opportunities. State Department officials have approved putting monitors in the Bosnian border to see if the Serb government does stop sending in arms and other goods to Bosnian Serbs. However, Christopher has given no indication that he plans another trip to Europe in the near future. In Germany, trial began today for two men accused of one of the most violent attacks against foreigners in a two-year wave of right-wing violence. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
25-year-old Michael Peters and 19-year-old Lars Christensen are charged with three counts of murder. They were arrested shortly after an arson attack on two houses in the northern German city of Mun that killed a Turkish woman, her granddaughter, and a niece. International condemnation of the attack prompted the Bonn government to launch a crackdown on far right-wing violence. At the trial opening, both defendants said they were only fringe members of neo-Nazi groups. The younger defendant, Christensen, claimed he was not guilty and distanced himself sharply from extremist right-wing viewpoints. Although there have been fewer attacks against foreigners this year in Germany, the right-wing violence continues. Last night in central Germany, two Albanian refugees were beaten viciously by a group of men in what police suspect was a racially motivated attack. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 7 points to close at 3,449.93 on volume of more than 228 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-4. This is NPR News. President Clinton is on a two-day Western trip, and today he toured the New Mexico lab where the atomic bomb was developed. Scientists at the plant are now converting defense experiments into projects for civilian use. Mr. Clinton used his visit to that facility to underline his plan to ease deep military cuts by investing in programs that convert military technology into civilian projects. Mr. Clinton's Western trip is also an effort by the White House to put more attention on the nation's economy. Tonight, the president will hold a town hall-type meeting in San Diego. After numerous delays and changes of venue, the retrial of a Miami police officer for the 1989 deaths of two black men began today in Orlando. Doug Phillips reports from Orlando.
In opening statements to the jury, prosecutor Gerald Bagley said William Lozano committed manslaughter when he fired the shot which killed a black motorcycle driver and his passenger.
This case is about one police officer, the defendant, who on January 16, 1989, was grossly negligent in the performance of his duties as a police officer.
Bagley said Lozano's negligence cost two people their lives and needlessly put others in danger. But defense attorney Roy Black said Lozano's duty as a police officer left him in harm's way that night and that he feared for his life as the motorcyclist sped toward him. Lozano shot in self-defense, Black said. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Orlando.
In New York City, the U.S. has told Russian officials that Secretary of State Warren Christopher will not attend a meeting of U.N. Security Council foreign ministers. U.S. officials do not believe a meeting on peacekeeping operations is needed at this time. Another factor is disagreement among allies over Bosnia. Russia's foreign minister is expected in New York this Friday. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, the American Society of Cinematographers gave its Lifetime Achievement Award to Haskell Wexler. It was the first time an active cinematographer received the honor. Wexler won Oscars for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory, and he received an Oscar nomination for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Matewan. His other films include Colors, Coming Home, The Hoodlum Priest, America, America, and In the Heat of the Night. He also directed some very controversial documentaries, including Introduction to the Enemy, about the trip Jane Fonda made to North Vietnam during the war. He incorporated documentary footage into his 1970 feature film Medium Cool, which he wrote, directed, and shot. That was about a TV news cameraman during the riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. During the 40 years that Wexler has worked in film, the technology has changed dramatically. When he was starting out, he shot in black and white, and he had to use ingenuity when he didn't have the technology to get the shot he wanted.
Well, when I started, we had just the camera and the person mostly, and if you wanted to do a dolly shot, particularly working in Chicago where I began, you'd get in the back of the trunk of a car and you'd have a friend drive the car, or you'd get in some kid's little wagon that he plays with and have someone pull that for dolly shots. Lighting was very primitive, and still it was really the way to learn, because sometimes some of the modern technology is so extreme and so compartmentalized that we lose sight of exactly what we're doing.
Is there a shot for a feature film that you did in a kid's wagon getting pulled along?
Oh, I used to do that all the time. In fact, I kept a wagon that was a young boy lived next door to me, and I kept his wagon until he was about 18 years old and used it on a number of documentaries in Chicago.
But not feature films?
No, in feature films, even on Virginia Woolf, I had a thing which the Grips called the paraplegic, which was a wheelchair thing that I had made up years before, where I could stand on this bicycle-like device and be pushed down the hall and then step off it with a handheld camera. I used it in a shot where Richard Burton goes down the hall to get a gun in a closet, and I wanted to get some excitement. The hallway was too narrow for the dollies that they had at that time, so it was quite useful.
You did one of the early helicopter shots for films, and thinking of the last shot in the movie Picnic, and you were the second unit cinematographer on that. Would you describe the shot and how you did it?
Well, the helicopter was a U.S. Navy helicopter. There were no civilian helicopters available to film companies, and so they just made some stuff out of 2x4 wood, and I would straddle a 2x4 out from the helicopter with the camera on a what we call a hi-hat, which is a low metal stand. We were shooting CinemaScope on that film, which is anamorphic, so the lens is very big, and of course the camera in those days were very heavy. And I had a rope around my waist, and the rope was attached into the helicopter in case I fell off. And the shot was a shot that began with Kim Novak going out of a house and getting into a bus. And then it was supposed to go over the countryside and find a freight train on which Bill Holden was standing. And then after seeing a good look at the freight train, the camera was supposed to move up into the sky for the end credits.
So let me get this straight. You were not in the helicopter, but dangling outside of it on a 2x4?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there's a still picture of me. I had forgotten it, actually, because that just, I didn't think anything of it. Yeah, we'd sit on it like on a horse, on a 2x4, and holding onto the camera.
What did it feel like? It must have been a real dizzying feeling.
Well, you know, the whole idea of fear when you're looking through the camera is a different phenomenon. I mean, I've been in wars and riots and hung out of many helicopters in the early days, and there's a detachment that happens when you look through the camera. You're looking for the shot, and it's only in recent years that I think about myself as being a vulnerable human being, even if I am a cameraman.
What do you think of it now, because you've gotten older?
Well, yeah, I don't do helicopter shots anymore. I just think maybe my time is running out as far as, because there have been a number of accidents and of cameramen hurting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once in a Western I was shooting, that stuntman was supposed to jump off a cliff, and he actually was supposed to fall off the cliff, and he did it extremely poorly. It was a low-budget Western, so I was very angry, and I said, damn it, this is how you do it. I'm going to do a terrific shot. So I had a little hand camera, and I jumped off this cliff, and there was a big mattress about 15 feet below, which I was supposed to fall on, but I didn't. And I just sort of nicked it and then rolled down the rest of the hillside. And they took me to the hospital. And all the way to the hospital and everything, I said, oh, God, I don't care. I got the greatest, most real jump-off shot that ever was. Then when we did see the shot, all it was, you just see some blur of sky and some bushes. And it was, it may have been realistic, but it wasn't a good shot.
You were a cinematographer on the film Gimme Shelter, which was the concert film at the Altamont Festival.
Terror. I have to explain. I was not the cinematographer on Gimme Shelter. I was going to be, and I met with Mick for a week and a half while they were trying to figure out where they were going to have the concert. And then at the last minute, I was worried because, well, because things were so up in the air, and I was around so many weird people. It was weird to me at that time, you know, with teeny boppers and grass being smoked and all kinds of crazy things going on, that I called my friends the Maisels in New York, and the Maisels shot Gimme Shelter.
Oh, so you didn't work on it?
No, I didn't work on it. I did give refuge to the Maisels after the concert because the... I'm trying to think of how much of this I should say. The people who were involved in the killing that happened at Altamont threatened the lives of the Maisels. And so they hid out at my place in Malibu until they were able to work a deal to buy them a new Harley-Davidson. And then the death threat against the Maisels was released.
So these people wanted the Maisels dead unless they destroyed the footage?
Well, they said that they were life actors in the Maisels film, and they wanted to be paid $40,000 for being life actors in a dramatic film.
Huh.
This was the Hell's Angels. I'm sure none of them are around anymore. It was settled. A digger named Emmett Grogan worked the transaction for us so that the contract on the Maisels was lifted.
My guest is cinematographer Haskell Wexler, and he this year got the American Society of Cinematographers Lifetime Achievement Award. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I guess the cinematographer Haskell Wexler. He won Academy Awards for his work on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory, and he got Oscar nominations for his work on Matewan and Blaze. You've done a lot of documentary work throughout your career. On your feature medium, Cool, which you wrote, directed, and shot, you used documentary footage, even though it was a fiction feature film. And part of the documentary footage that you used was of the organizing at the Chicago Convention and the riots there. You were actually shooting during some tear gassing, and you got gassed while you were shooting.
Yes, I did, and so did some members of our crew. There was no actually stock footage in Medium Cool. I wrote the script, I wrote the riots, and I integrated the actors in the film in the park during the demonstrations. But nowhere was it like we had stock footage and then later in editing integrated in the film. It was all done at the time.
So when you were shooting the demonstration that ended up getting tear gassed and you got gassed yourself, I imagine you had to stop shooting then.
Yes, I had to stop shooting. I certainly didn't know that tear gas felt like it has, like it does. I don't know whether you've ever experienced it, but when you hear the word tear gas, you think, well, your eyes will burn and that's it. But that whole feeling of your whole, your skin burning, that you can't breathe, you can't inhale, you feel suffocated, it's a very, very terrifying experience.
One of the issues in Medium Cool is, does being behind the camera, shooting the action, remove you from the action and remove you from any responsibility for what happens? Was that a big issue for you personally?
Yes, I think that the whole voyeuristic attitude of filmmakers, or of me personally, of shooting documentaries and so forth, is an important issue, and it was an important issue to me personally. And the whole question of when do you put the camera down, and or when do you keep shooting to get the shot? And a number of times in my life, I've had that question hit me very hard. When I was in Vietnam with Jane Fonda, I was shooting a farmer in the field. Just a pastoral scene. While I was shooting him, an explosion occurred. He blew up right in my lens, so to speak. And he had stepped in a landmine. And some people came out. They were like paramedics, came out from a little clinic and carried him in to this little house where they treated him with herbs and things. And I was shooting all this time. And there was only one guy who was helped to pull him, and I had to think whether I was going to keep shooting or help the guy. And so I kept shooting, and then they put him in this little clinic, and I photographed through the window while they had to amputate his leg. And I felt very strange because I felt I could have helped, but I didn't help. But then I also felt elated that I was getting a shot that would be important to the film.
Looking back, are you sorry that you kept shooting instead of helping?
I try not to think about it because mm-hmm. I rationalize out, well, how much help could you really be, you know? And maybe if people saw this, they'd realize the brutality of war and figure out there's got to be some better way than killing human beings who are just trying to farm a field.
You've done a lot of political documentaries, but you've also done hundreds of TV commercials. Is that a contradiction at all, especially considering that the documentaries have been for, anti-imperialist causes? You've done a lot of documentaries in Vietnam, Central America. Mm. So is there any conflict in your mind between, selling your services for a lot of money to make commercials and then, you know, doing things probably at your own expense that were documentaries about politics?
Well, there is a contradiction in a sense. If you're making commercials which sell products which are unhealthy or which are unnecessary, I think that you are part of a system. I am part of a system which encourages people to buy things and do things which are not to their best interest. And to that extent, you could say it was contradictory.
Some of the many commercials that you've shot over the years were for Marlboro cigarettes. You did a lot of the Marlboro Man campaign, right?
Oh.
Can you talk a little bit about getting what? what were you going to say?
So you looked me up pretty good.
Yeah, we got your number. But I'm really interested, you know, since that became such an iconic commercial, and then it became so controversial afterwards because one of the Marlboro men got cancer. Lung cancer. So can you talk a little bit about creating the image, creating the icon?
Well, of course, the general idea was dreamed up by the advertising agency. And so my job was to realize that. And we went down to Lubbock, Texas, usually, and onto a ranch, and we'd pick cowboys who looked the part and photograph them under dramatic situations, you know, rounding up wild horses or running through streams and then reaching in and taking a drag on a cigarette. Now, I have to, in my defense, I have to say that the general knowledge of the deadly nature of cigarettes was not primarily in my mind, nor was it on these poor cowboys who, many of whom have died of emphysema since we were shooting. I do notice that American tobacco companies have big campaigns overseas now, and we are making cigarette addicts out of millions of Chinese and without the necessity of putting any Surgeon General report on them.
When you were younger, you joined the Merchant Marines. Why did you go to sea?
Well, it was patriotic, for one thing. It was just the beginning of World War II, and my dad had been in the Navy, and I just, I think I preferred that from my image of digging around in the mud like a grunt. I would prefer fighting the war from ships.
Mm-hmm. Now, a ship that you were on was torpedoed. I believe this was off the coast of Africa. And you were wounded, and you were on a lifeboat for 14 days with, I believe, 17 other men. Is that right? Do I have that right?
I don't know where you're reading all this stuff, but it's pretty accurate. Yes, it was in 1942. I was on a ship called the Excello, coming back from the Red Sea, and we were sunk off the coast of Africa by a German submarine, and was in a lifeboat for 14 days, and landed and lived with the Pondos in South Africa while. Who took care of us and took care of me. I had some wound in my left leg.
Just give me a sense of what it was like to be on that raft for 14 days. Were you sitting? Were you lying? Was there room for your whole body to stretch out? Were you in a lot of pain?
Well, I was, I think I was 19, and we were in a lifeboat, not in a raft, and we were jammed in the first couple of nights with difficult because they're heavy swells, and I had a thing like a bicycle pump, which is a bilge pump like thing to pump the water that was coming in the lifeboat, and I had one of the guys, the saloon messman, I asked him to hold the hose over the side because it had a curl in it, and I had to pump, and I pumped with my right arm till it gave out, and pumped to my left until it gave out, and then I noticed that he had collapsed and that the hose was not going over the side of the lifeboat, but went back into the lifeboat. And I think that was the only time that I really felt like I wanted to give up. And then we had chief engineer, a guy named Finnegan, who came back. He was an older guy, and he came back because we needed chief engineers at that time. And he died on the boat. And another guy and I had to decide whether he was really dead. You know how in the movies they just sort of reach down, look at somebody, and they say, oh, he's dead. Well, it's not that easy. At least it wasn't for us. And so after putting things in front of his mouth and trying, we realized he was dead. And so a guy named Milt McCord, and I had to dump him over the side, and that was a rough time because he was a good guy, and it was the first time I really was close to anyone dying.
And you had to be the one to declare that he was dead, and you weren't even.
Well, most.
That's certain.
Besides Milt McCord and I, two guys in the boat, were about the strongest. In best conditions. A lot of the guys had swallowed a lot of oil, and some of them had gotten shrapnel from the when the torpedo went off. And so we were sort of in charge of the boat.
Do you think that you had the courage to do certain things you might not have done if it wasn't for that experience?
I do. I think that it gave me a really strong feeling of my life force, and a confidence in myself. I felt like I was a man. Before that point, for some reason, I always felt I was a boy. In fact, they called me the baby on the ship because I was the youngest guy on the ship. But I always felt that way. And then I felt that experience, because of the responsible nature that I found I acted all during that traumatic time, that I felt that I was a man.
Was being a cinematographer on commercial films any more gratifying earlier in your career, or is it more gratifying now? I'm wondering, in other words, how much the industry has changed, and if you have any more or less freedom, if you enjoy the films you're making any more or less.
The business has changed, and I use the word business very carefully, because when I first started making features, people made features because they wanted to make that picture, because that picture said something about humanity, said something about human relations, said something about something. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't make pictures to make money, but the commercial aspects of what is a good picture, a successful picture, has overridden what I think is some of the artistic benefits of movie making. That doesn't mean, I mean, I'm always surprised how many good pictures do get made, but the avalanche of pictures which are presented because of testing, because of trying to reach a certain audience in a certain way, leads to prefabricated ideas and repetitious ideas that don't really elevate the whole stature of motion picture business.
Well, Haskell Wexler, I wish we had more time to talk. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Cinematographer Haskell Wexler. He's featured in the new documentary about cinematography called Visions of Light. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. J. Jeff Bridges was called the most underappreciated great actor of his generation by Janet Maslin of the New York Times. Bridges is the star of such films as The Last Picture Show, Winter Kills, Cutter's Way, Against All Odds, Jagged Edge, and The Fisher King. He's now starring as an ex-con reunited with his son in the new film American Heart. We'll talk with Bridges about his films and about his father's old TV series, Sea Hunt. Also, imagine a time when instead of opening a book, you bring it up on a computer screen. Would it be the end of books as we know them? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg wonders about the future. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton traveled to Los Alamos, New Mexico today, home of the laboratory that made the atomic bomb. He was there to talk about his economic plan and his program for defense conversion. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton has promised a 5-year, $20 billion program to help communities like Los Alamos adjust to the loss of defense contracts and convert their labs to civilian production. The president hammered away at the theme that the country is suffering from twin deficits, the budget deficit and a lack of investment in areas like high technology.
If we refuse to bring our deficit down and we still continue to squeeze these areas critical to our investment future, the alternative will be a rising deficit, a declining rate of investment, more unemployment, and more stagnant incomes, longer work weeks for less funds, and continued insecurity for America's working families.
Tonight, Mr. Clinton will travel to San Diego, California, where he'll return to one of his favorite campaign formats, a live televised town meeting. In Los Alamos, I'm Mara Liasson.
The U.S. has endorsed the idea of putting international observers on the border between Serbia and Bosnia to make sure Serbia is abiding by its pledge not to provide arms or other supplies to the Bosnian Serbs. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher implied that the U.S. may ask the U.N. to arm the monitors. Boucher dismissed a Russian proposal to hold a foreign ministers' meeting at the U.N. on Friday to discuss peacekeeping operations in the former Yugoslavia. Boucher said the time is wrong because Congress is in the process of deciding how much to spend on peacekeeping. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen has announced an inquiry into the events leading up to the fatal standoff at the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Bentsen says the department will investigate the decision made by officials from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to storm the Waco compound on February 28th. Bentsen also introduced a 3-member panel to review Treasury's probe. Participants are Ed Guthman, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Willie Williams, chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, and Henry Ruth, a former Watergate prosecutor. Bentsen said the panel will guide and review the inquiry, but they won't conduct it themselves.
We want an impartial, comprehensive, an uncompromising inquiry. And we want the American people to know what happened and why.
Assistant Secretary for Enforcement Ron Noble said the probe will determine whether ATF agents lost the element of surprise in their raid, as has been alleged by anonymous agents. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 7 points to close at 3449.93. Declines led advances by a small margin. This is NPR. The people of Denmark vote tomorrow on a treaty that would set up a stronger political and economic bloc in Europe. Danes rejected the treaty a year ago because it would have interfered with the country's liberal social welfare system. Denmark has negotiated some exemptions from the treaty's provisions, and recent polls show Danes leaning toward accepting the treaty. The Danish Prime Minister warned his people today that they will never be forgiven if they block Europe's new start. Britain is the only other member of the European community that has not ratified the treaty. Consumer activist Ralph Nader is calling for congressional hearings on the treatment of women in the marketplace and what he says is a pattern of discrimination in areas such as insurance, auto repairs, and health care. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
Nader says while women are making gains in achieving equality in the workplace, there is still a great deal of discrimination in the marketplace, ranging from relatively minor areas like dry cleaning bills to more critical matters such as pensions and unnecessary surgery. Nader cited a study by consumer writer Frances Sarah Whittlesey, which details excuses offered by businesses who set different standards when it comes to male and female customers.
Some will say, quote, well, women will pay a lot more than men, end quote. That relates to fashion, things like shoes and clothing. Other sellers will say, women can't be expected to know about technical things like cars or plumbing.
Nader says women themselves have an obligation to report incidents of discrimination to local and federal authorities. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
A former Bell System company and a conglomerate that owns cable television systems are uniting to offer a new service. The $2.5 billion project would allow cable TV customers to order movies anytime, do their banking, and make phone connections through their TV sets. The firms say the deal should be final by the end of the year. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jeff Bridges is the leading man of the family. His brother is character actor Beau Bridges. Their father, Lloyd Bridges, spent a lot of time underwater filming the TV series Sea Hunt when the boys were growing up. Jeff Bridges' films include The Last Picture Show, Jagged Edge, Against All Odds, and The Fisher King. He starred with his brother in The Fabulous Baker Boys and worked with his father in Tucker. Now Jeff Bridges is starring in the new film American Heart, which he also co-produced. When the film opens, his character, Jack Kelson, has just gotten out of jail and is thinking of heading north from Seattle to Alaska. But the son he abandoned years ago has found him, and that's a responsibility Jack doesn't want. The film is based on the documentary Streetwise about street kids in Seattle. The director of Streetwise, Martin Bell, also directed American Heart. I asked Bridges how he got involved with American Heart.
About 3 years ago, I opened my production company, As Is Productions, for business, and we started looking at different scripts. And a script came to us that was very moving. And I thought that if I could move audiences like I was moved by the script, that this would be something that I would want to produce. It had a few problems with it. It had the mafia was involved. It was set down in New Orleans, and especially the mafia stuff wasn't ringing true to me, and the rest of the movie was quite realistic. And we worked on that script for about a year, and I was about to call it quits when they said, well, maybe you should look at the original script that one was based on. Everybody has turned it down because they felt it was maybe too hard a look at the situation. And we looked at that script, and that's the one that we actually used and is on the screen today. And now it's 2 years later, and we've finally got it up on the screen, so it's very rewarding.
Did you pattern your character in American Heart on anyone in particular?
Yeah, we were real fortunate to have with us as a technical advisor a fellow named Eddie Bunker, whose own life really paralleled my character's, in that he was raised by the state, you know, had no real family support of any kind. He was, you know, raised in different state homes, and then spent lots of time in prison, and then graduated the the criminal university system that we have here in this country, and tried to turn his life around and did a miraculous job in doing so. One of the things that helped him was that he happened to be a very very skilled writer, and he's written many novels. One of them, No Beast So Fierce, was adapted for screen, Dustin Hoffman film Straight Time, and he also wrote the screenplay for that. And he also wrote the screenplay for Runaway Train as well. So he was a writer, had done a lot of time in prison, and he was also an actor. So he was on the set, and I would use him as a touchstone. You know, he really grounded my character in reality for me.
Jeff Bridges is my guest. He stars in the new film American Heart. Can we go back to the beginning, talk about your early days?
Sure.
Okay. I have to confess to you that, like a lot of, I'm about your age. I think I'm a year
younger than you are. So, like a lot of people, I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of people, I grew up watching Sea Hunt, right?
That's right.
I grew up living in an apartment building in Brooklyn, New York, but I knew how to prevent getting the bends.
Very good.
Yeah, like this is going to be real useful information to me.
Can you hum the Sea Hunt theme?
Gosh, you know, I don't think I can. Can you? Go ahead.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Something like that. I gotta get off there at the end.
No, were your friends, did they watch the show, and did that mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah, sure. They watched the show. A lot of them liked it. You know, occasionally I would get the, you think you're so great, you're Mike Nelson's kid. Yeah, you think you're real great, don't you? You know, I get some of that. But all in all, it was, you know, the kids pretty much dug it, I thought.
You were on some episodes when you were a kid? How old were you, and what were the scenes? What did you have to do?
Oh, I was about, I think on the first one, maybe about 9 years old. I remember being trapped in a cave, and Mike Nelson had to dive under there and get me. And my girlfriend of the time, my neighbor, Andy Kaplan, was playing my partner in that one. And my dad, Mike Nelson, had to swim under there and save us, and... I remember telling my girlfriend, I said, well, maybe if we sing, they'll hear us and they'll save us. And I had to sing a song.
Underwater? Oh, this was an underwater cave. This was a regular
cave. It's like, you know, the tide is rising, you know, and trapped us in this cave.
Of course.
I remember being thrown off Malibu Pier in the middle of winter and, you know, having to say my lines with the cold water, you know, that sort of thing.
Whose idea was it for you to do the episodes, yours or your father's?
It was my dad's. You know, he said, there's a little kid part in here, you want to do it? And took me a second, then I realized I could get out of school for the week, and so I said, yeah, I'll do that.
Actor Jeff Bridges is my guest. Back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Actor Jeff Bridges is my guest. He stars in the new movie American Heart. Let me ask you, your brother Beau Bridges was 9 years older than you. Did he ever have to take care of you when you were young? And did you, like, tag along with him and his friends against his will?
Being 8 years older, it was almost, a lot of times it was a kind of an uncle, you know, nephew relationship almost.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have the typical kind of competition, really. You know, I looked up to him, and he was always so great in sports. He was scouted by the Dodgers, you know, and he was on the UCLA basketball team. And for a guy who was, you know, I think he's about 5'10 or 11, you know, he was playing out there with Walt Hazard and all those guys. And, you know, he taught me how to do all those sports and box and everything. So he was, you know... Yeah, I really did look up to him. He really was my hero. And then he taught me how to act, and we would do, we used to do this thing, this idea we came up with where, you know, so often you talk to actors and they say, you know, it's tough because we need an audience, you know, and there's no audience. You can't just act in your room by yourself. That's not gratifying at all. So what Beau and I would do is we'd rent a flatbed truck, and we would play the supermarket circuit. We would get a few scenes together, and we would go into a supermarket parking lot, and we would get on the back of the flatbed truck, and we would act, and we would get people to all come around and watch our show and improvise and do kind of crazy things until the cops would come, and then we'd try to include the cops in the show, and they would kind of get flustered, and then one of us would get in the driver's seat and drive off to the next supermarket.
So it's kind of a strange thing to do, pull up a flatbed truck to a supermarket parking lot and put on a little show. What did people make of it?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, sometimes we would start it with a fight. You know, my father taught us how to fake fight, you know, do stage fighting. So sometimes we would start it with a fight, you know, to get people saying, what's happening, to get a crowd around us. And then we would say, we're just kidding. We're going to put on a show. And then they'd gather around. It's a good idea. I recommend it highly for all you actors out there who need an audience.
Now, one of your early films was the remake of King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Did it turn out like you expected?
Oh, not really. You know, I was a big fan of the original. I remember, you know, faking sick just to get out of school to see that thing. You know, I love that original movie.
Me too.
And it worked all right. I mean, it was tough. It's a tough acting assignment to have to do all that, you know, with all the technical stuff, because that the acting kind of takes a back seat to that.
Did you have to do a lot of scenes in which there was a mechanical ape arm playing opposite you?
I did a few of those, but I remember being on the set when Jessica Lange was in this hand, and God, the camera should have been turned the other way, because I've never had this feeling, a combination of horror and laughing my head off, seeing the director, who was this English guy, directing these five Italians. Each man had a finger on this giant, had a control that controlled the finger of this huge gorilla paw. And Jesse was in this paw, and he finally, you know, he couldn't communicate with these guys in words, so he finally said, "Just look at my bloody hand." And he stuck his hand up in the air. He had all these five Italian guys looking at his hand, trying to, you know, figure out how much he should squeeze the fingers. And Jessica almost got crushed several times. I mean, you know, it was very painful for her. Terrible situation.
I hear you laughing.
Yeah, well, it was very, very strange.
Another of your early movies was Heaven's Gate, which came to kind of symbolize excess in Hollywood. It clocked in at 3 hours and 49 minutes. It was $36 million. Did you have a sense that things were going wrong when you were making the movie?
Not wrong. We had an amazing time making that film. Mike Cimino had just come off The Deer Hunter, which was a terrific film, and he was got a lot of praise for it, and people really were looking for him to make the huge, you know, epic Western. And that's what we were out to do. I remember Mike wanted us all to stay up there in Montana, and you know, whether we had scenes to shoot or not. And when we weren't shooting, which would, you know, in my case, it would sometimes I would go three weeks, a month without shooting a scene. And he would put us all practicing our skills that we had to do in the movie. We called it Camp Cimino, that we all went to. And he would, you know, each person had different things that he had to practice, you know, like rioting, and I had to practice cockfighting and Yugoslavian and all kinds of, you know, guns, shooting and all that stuff. And it was, you know, terrific to hang out with all those great actors, John Hurt, and terrific musicians. Chris Christopherson brought a lot of his band up and had parts in the film. T-Bone Burnett and Willem Dafoe played my maids, I guess, or whatever you would call them, that cleaned up the, you know, the hotel and stuff. And so we had a lot of music going on the set all the time. So we had, you know, we didn't have any idea that it was going to, well, you know, that it would happen like that. I was quite surprised.
What do you think of the film? A lot of people, you know, it's out on video. A lot of people haven't seen it because of its reputation. Do you think it deserves that reputation, or do you think it's a good film?
I think it's an amazing film. It captures that time in this country probably better than any other film. I think some of the shots of that Vilmos Zsigmon did a gorgeous job, you know, creating that look for the film, and the sets and the costumes are, you know, brilliant. The story is terrific. You know, it's kind of in my view, it's like the birth of a cynic. You know, a guy who starts out very optimistic and is going to change the world, and how he becomes a cynic and what the price of that cynicism is. I think it's a terrific story, and it's a great movie. It was, there are things that, the rhythm isn't a typical American film rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember the first time I saw it, it was a little disconcerting the way that we'd kind of like linger on something and the pace seemed a little odd. But I've seen it, I don't know, four, five, six times now, and each time I see it, I get more with its rhythm rather than trying to impose mine on it.
Right.
And I'm a fan of that film, and I think it'll be interesting, 10 years down the line when the reviews died, the news of the reviews died down and it let the movie kind of speak for itself. I think it may get a new audience.
Well, I've got one last question for you.
Yay.
Did you ever get the bends?
Did I ever get the bends? No, but I've had nitrogen narcosis several times.
Have you really?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I haven't, but I would like to have.
Did you ever go deep sea diving?
Yes, to get nitrogen narcosis. I've been skin diving. Yeah, especially when my dad was doing Sea Hunt, we would go skin diving quite a bit, and also scuba diving.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, good luck with the new movie.
Thanks a lot, Terry. Appreciate talking with you.
Jeff Bridges stars in the new film American Heart. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, now that the peace plan has been voted down in a popular vote, what do you have about what's next in Bosnia?
Well, even though the votes are still being counted, it's pretty clear that it has been defeated by the Bosnian Serbs. We'll be hearing from NPR's Deborah Amos about what happens now and some of the diplomatic activity that's now begun, particularly Russian diplomatic activity. Also, a talk with Alexa Gilas, a Yugoslav-born political scientist at Harvard who has an idea for what should happen. He says Bosnia should simply be partitioned, part of it going to Serbia, part to Croatia, part of it remaining a much smaller independent state. And also a talk with Jackie McLean about the saxophone and drugs.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a lot of debate about the fate of books in the information age. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts.
One of the great glories of the manuscript collection of the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris is the Vivien Bible. It was produced in the 9th century by the monks of Tours as a gift to the Frankish king Charles the Bald. The illuminated frontispiece shows the monks in procession presenting the magnificently clad volume to the king. It's a symbolic enactment of the role that the book played in the medieval world as a link between secular and religious authority. Well, as the French themselves say, plus ça change. The French ruler is a socialist now, but he's still bald. And the intellectuals have left the cloisters, but literary culture and the book still count for a lot in French political life. This is doubtless what François Mitterrand had in mind when he called in his ministers a couple of years ago to discuss what to do for the last and greatest of the public works with which every French administration leaves its mark on the capital. What he said simply was, I want a very big library. And in due course, the new Bibliothèque de France began to rise on the left bank in the shape of four vast towers that will replace the old Bibliothèque Nationale as the repository of what the French describe as their national patrimony. A lot of people think it's the last great library that will ever be built, at least out of bricks and mortar. Within a few decades, they say, there'll be no more need to gather all these books in one place, or to go out in the rain to consult them. The new books will all be published digitally, and the old ones will all have been electronically scanned, so that everything ever printed will be available anywhere in the world over electronic nets. This doesn't necessarily mean the end of paper books. Paper will still be the most agreeable way of reading a long text and the most convenient form for taking it to the beach. But there will no longer be any need to distribute the books in printed form. You can just print out a copy in the local bookstore or at the printer alongside of your workstation. And there will be no call for these huge repositories of printed texts, or for library cards, or recall notices. The digital library is coming, that's certain. As part of their program, the French are planning to digitize over 200,000 works by 1995. There's a committee charged with choosing the text that will form the core of the electronic collection. And the French are having a grand time debating the sort of question that seems made for them. If you only had 250,000 books to take to the moon, what would they be? It's happening here, too, as major libraries begin to scan in the contents of their collections for distribution over the information highways that will be built with federal help in the next decade or so. It's an exhilarating vision which inspires its enthusiasts to orgies of cyber prose. From vast databases that constitute the culture's deposited wealth, every document is available, every recording is playable, every picture is viewable, the realm of pure information filling like a lake. Well, I'm an enthusiast too, after my fashion. I do my info surfing on the rollers of the internet and the commercial databases. I was sitting at my computer the other evening when a friend called from a dinner party where everybody was trying to remember the name of Uta Hagen's husband. Hang on, I said, it's at the tip of my tongue. I logged into one of the databases of the Dialogue Information Service, gave it the keywords Uta Hagen and husband, and cleared my throat for a minute or so until the screen flashed back the name of Herbert Berghoff. I have great credit in that circle now, or will until they hear this. But the digital library is less convenient when I'm after something a little less easy to pin down. Something entertaining about tomatoes, a good left-wing history of the Chartist movement, a copy of that guidebook I used in Chicago 20 years ago, the one with a blue cover. I know they're all in there, of course, but disembodied and stripped of the characteristics that might help me get hold of them. I can't just give the system some general keywords. I'll be overwhelmed. That database where I located the name of Uta Hagen's husband contains 119,000 occurrences of the word tomato, for example. At times like these, the image of infospace seems not quite right. It's more like the information tar pit. I need stacks to browse, covers to look at, happy accidents of contiguity. I gotta get out of the house. The interface people tell me it's early days yet, and I have faith in them. But in the meantime, I'll hang on to my umbrella.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Our senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the classic jazz of Butch Thompson. The former pianist with the Prairie Home Companion has a series of recordings featuring the music of Fats Waller, Jelly Roll Morton, Hubie Blake, Scott Joplin, and others. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.